pleasure to be back in York, and an opportunity to be able to address this particular topic with such an audience. My title is Renewing the Face of the Earth. And some modern philosophers have spoken about the human face as the most potent sign of what it is that we can't master or exhaust in the life of a human other. The face as a sign of the claim upon us of the other, the depths we can't sound but must respect. And while, of course, it's so ancient a metaphor to talk about the face of the earth that we barely notice any longer that it is a metaphor, it doesn't do any harm to let some of these associations find their way into our thinking. Because such associations in the word face resonate so strongly with a fundamental biblical insight into the nature of our relationship with the world we inhabit. The earth is the Lord's, says the 24th Psalm. In its context, this is primarily an assertion of God's glory and overall sovereignty. And it affirms a relation between God and the world that's independent of what we, as human beings, think about the world or do to the world. The world is in the hands of another. The earth we inhabit is more than we can get hold of in any one moment, or even in the sum total of all the moments we spend with it. Its destiny is not bound only to human destiny. Its story is not exhausted by the history of our particular culture or technology, or even by the history of the entire human race. We can't, as humans, oblige the environment to follow our agenda in all things, however much we can bend certain natural forces to our will. We can't control the weather system or the succession of the seasons. The world turns, and the tides move at the drawing of the moon. Human force is incapable of changing any of this. What lies before me is a network of relations and interconnections in which the relation to me, or even to us collectively as human beings, is very far from the whole story. I may ignore this, but only at the cost of disaster. And it would be dangerously illusory to imagine that this material environment will adjust itself at all costs so as to maintain our relationship to it. If it is more than us, more than our relation to it, it can survive us. We are dispensable. But the earth remains the Lord's. Now, this language is used still more pointedly in a passage like Leviticus 25:23. We are foreign and temporary tenants on a soil that belongs to the Lord. We can never possess the land in which we live so as to do what we like with it. In a brilliant recent monograph, the American Old Testament scholar Ellen Davis points out that the 25th chapter of Leviticus is in fact a sustained argument about enslavement and alienation in a number of interconnected contexts. The people and the land alike belong to God. So that ownership of a person within God's chosen community is anomalous in a similar way to ownership of the land. When the Israelite loses family property, he must live alongside members of his family as if he were a resident alien, 23:35. But the reader is reminded that in relation to God, the entire community, settled by God, of his own gratuitous gift in the land of Canaan, has the same status of resident aliens. When there is no alternative for the impoverished person but to be sold into slavery, an Israelite buying such a slave must treat them as a hired servant. And if the purchaser is not an Israelite, there is an urgent obligation on the family to see that they are redeemed. Alan Davis points out that the obligation to redeem the enslaved Israelite is connected by way of several verbal echoes with the obligation defined earlier of redeeming, buying back family land alienated as a result of poverty. Verses 24 to 28. The language of redemption applies both to the land and to the people. Both are in God's hands, and thus the people called to imitate the holiness of God will be seeking to save both persons and property from being alienated forever, their primary defining relation to the God of the Exodus. Primary and defining relation. This is the core of a biblical ethic of responsibility for the environment. To understand that we and our environment are alike in the hands of God, so that neither can be possessed absolutely, is to see that the mysteriousness of the interior life of another person and the uncontrollable difference and resistance of the material world are connected. Both demand that we don't regard relationships centered upon us, upon our individual or group agendas, as the determining factor in how we approach persons or things. If, as this whole section of the book of Leviticus assumes, God's people are called to reflect what God is like, to make God's holiness visible, then a just or good action is action which reflects God's purpose of liberating persons and environment from possession and from the exploitation that comes from it. Liberating them in order that their primary and defining relation may be realized. Just action towards people and environment is letting created reality, both human and non-human, stand before God, unhindered by attempts to control and to dominate. It's a rather different reading of the biblical tradition to that often lazily assumed to be the orthodoxy of Judeo-Christian belief. We hear regularly that this tradition authorizes the exploitation of the earth through the language in Genesis about having dominion over the non-human creation. As has been argued elsewhere, this is a very clumsy reading of what Genesis actually says. But set alongside the Levitical code, and as Ellen Davis argues, many other aspects of the theology of Jewish scripture, the malign interpretation that has latterly been taken for granted by critics of Judaism and Christianity appears profoundly mistaken. But what remains to be teased out is more about the nature of the human calling to further the redemption of persons and world. If liberating action is allowing things and persons to stand before God free from claims to possession, is the responsibility of human agents only to stand back and let natural processes unfold. Well, in Genesis, humanity is given the task of cultivating the Garden of Eden. We're not left simply to observe or to stand back. We're endowed with the responsibility to preserve and direct the powers of nature. And in this process, we become more fully and joyfully who and what we are. As St. Augustine memorably says, commenting on this passage, there is a joy, he says, in the experiencing of the powers of nature. Our own fulfillment is bound up with the work of conserving and focusing those powers. And the exercise of this work is meant, in St. Augustine's world, meant to be one of the things that holds us in paradise and makes it possible to resist temptation. And the implication is that an attitude to work, which regards the powers of nature as simply a threat to be overcome, is best seen as an effect of the fall, a sign of alienation. As the monastic scholar Aylward Squire points out, this insight of St. Augustine, quoted by St. Thomas Aquinas, is then echoed by Aquinas himself in another passage, where he describes humanity as having a share in the working of divine providence, because humanity has the task of using its reasoning powers to provide providence, you see, to provide for self and others. And the Latin word he uses for others can mean both persons and things. In other words, the human task is to draw out potential treasures in the powers of nature, and so to realize the convergent process of humanity and nature discovering in collaboration what they can become. The redemption of people and material life in general isn't a matter of resigning from the business of labor and transformation, as if we could. It's the search for a form of action that'll preserve and nourish an interconnected development of humanity and its environment. In some contexts, this will be the deliberate protection of the environment from harm. In a world where exploitative and aggressive behavior is commonplace, one of the providential tasks of human beings must be to limit damage and to secure space for the natural order to exist unharmed. In other contexts, the question is more how to use the natural order for the sake of human nourishment and security without pillaging its resources and so damaging its inner mechanisms for self-healing or self-correction. In both contexts, a fundamental requirement is to discern enough of what the processes of nature truly are to be able to engage intelligently. All of this suggests some definitions of what unintelligent and ungodly relation with the environment looks like. It is partial. That is, it refuses to see or understand that what can be grasped about natural processes is likely to be only one dimension of interrelations far more complex than we can gauge. It focuses on aspects of the environment that can be comparatively easily manipulated for human advantage and ignores inconvenient questions about what less obvious connections are being violated. It is indifferent, for example, to the way in which biodiversity is part of the self-balancing system of the world we inhabit. It is impatient. It seeks returns on labor that are prompt and low cost without consideration of long-term effects. It avoids or denies the basic truth that the environment as a material system is finite and cannot indefinitely regenerate itself in ways that will simply fulfill human needs or wants. And when such unintelligent and ungodly relation prevails, the risks should be obvious. We discover too late that we have turned a blind eye to the extinction of a species that is essential to the balance of life in a particular context. Or we discover too late that the importation of a foreign life, animal or vegetable, has upset local ecosystems, damaging soil or neighboring life forms. We discover that we have come near the end of supplies of fossil fuels, for example, on which we have built immense structures of routine expectation. Increasingly, we have to face the possibility not only of the now familiar problems of climate change, bad enough as these are, but of a whole range of doomsday prospects. Martin Rees's book of 2003, Our Final Century, outlined some of these prospects, noting also that the technology which in the hands of benign agents is assumed to be working for the good of humanity is the same technology which, universally available on the internet, can enable bioterror, threat to release pathogens against a population. This feels like an ultimate reversal of the relation between humanity and environment that's envisaged in the religious vision. The material world's processes deliberately harnessed to bring about domination by violence. Though when you think about it, that's only a projection of the existing history of military technology. A.S. Byatt's novel, The Biographer's Tale, tells the story, or rather a set of interconnected stories, of a writer engaging with the literary remains of a diverse collection of people, including Linnaeus, the great Swedish botanist. Late in the book, Fula, a Swedish entomologist, holds forth to the narrator and his friends about the varieties of devastation the world faces because of our ignorance of insect life, specifically the life of bees. I quote, "She told fearful tales of possible lurches in the population of pollinators, including those of the crops we depend on for our own lives. Tales of the destruction of the habitats by humans and of benign and necessary insects, birds, bats, and other creatures, by crop spraying and road building. Of the need to find other, often better pollinators in a world where they are being extinguished swiftly and silently. Of the fact that there are only 39 qualified bee taxonomists in the world whose average age is 60. Of population problems and feeding the world, and Cispania, a leguminous crop which could both hold back desertification because it binds soil and feed the starving, but for the fact that no one has studied its pollinators or their abundance or deficiency or their habits in sufficient detail. It's a potent catalogue of unintelligence." Earlier in the same book, Fuller has said that, I quote again, "we are an animal that needs to use its intelligence to mitigate the effects of its intelligence on the other creatures." A notable definition in the contemporary context of what the Levitical call to redemption might mean. We cannot but use our intelligence in our world, we are bound to use it, as Fuller's examples suggest, to supply need, to avoid famine and suffering. If the Christian vision outlined by Aquinas is truthful, our intelligence is an aspect of sharing in God's providence, and so it's committed to providing for others. But God's providence does not promote the good only of one sector of creation, and so we have to use our intelligence to seek the good of the whole system of which we are a part. The limits of our creative manipulation of what's put before us in our environment are not instantly self-evident, of course. But what's coming into focus is the level of risk involved if we never ask such a question. If we collude with a social and economic order that apparently takes the possibility of unlimited advance in material prosperity for granted, and systematically ignores the big picture of global interconnectedness in economics or in ecology. Ecological questions are increasingly being defined as issues of justice. Climate change has been characterized as a matter of justice, both to those who now have no part in decision-making at the global level, yet bear the heaviest burdens as a consequence of the irresponsibility of wealthier nations, and justice to those who will succeed us on this planet. Justice to our children and grandchildren. That's a theme spelled out very clearly, by the way, in Paula Clifford's new book, Angels with Trumpets, The Church in a Time of Global Warming, which I strongly recommend. So the major issue we need to keep in view is how much injustice is let loose by any given set of economic or manufacturing practices. We can't easily set out a straightforward code that will tell us precisely when and where we step across the line into the unintelligence and ungodliness that I've sketched. But we can at least see that the question is asked, and asked on the basis of a clear recognition that there's no way of manipulating our environment that is without cost or consequence, and thus also recognition that we're inextricably bound up with the destiny of our world. There is no guarantee that the world we live in will tolerate us indefinitely if we prove ourselves unable to live within its constraints. Is this, as some would claim, a failure to trust God, who has promised faithfulness to what he has made? I think that to suggest that God might intervene to protect us from the corporate folly of our practices is as unchristian and unbiblical as to suggest that he protects us from the results of our individual folly or sin. This is not a creation in which there are no real risks. Our faith has always held that the inexhaustible love of God cannot compel justice or virtue. We are capable of doing immeasurable damage to ourselves as individuals, and it seems clear that we have the same terrible freedom as a human race. God's faithfulness stands, assuring us that even in the most appalling disaster, love will not let us go. But it will not be a safety net that guarantees a happy ending in this world. Any religious language that implies this is making a nonsense of the prophetic tradition of the Old Testament and the urgency of the preaching of Jesus. But to say this is also to be reminded of the fact that intelligence is given to us. We are capable of changing our situation. And as A.S. Byatt's character puts it, of using our intelligence to limit the ruinous effect of our intelligence. If we can change things so appallingly for the worse, it's possible to change them for the better also. But in Christian terms, this needs a radical change of heart, a conversion. It needs another kind of redemption, which frees us from the trap of an egotism that obscures judgment. Intelligence, in regard to the big picture of our world, is no neutral thing, no simple natural capacity of reasoning. Needs grace to escape from the distortions of pride and acquisitiveness. And one of the things that we as Christians ought to be saying in the context of the ecological debate is that human reasoning, in its proper and fullest sense, requires an awareness of our participation in the material processes of the world, and thus a sense of reason's own involvement in what it can't finally master. Being rational is not a wholly detached capacity, examining the phenomena of the world from a distance. It's a set of skills for finding our way around in the physical world. So the ecological crisis challenges us to be reasonable. Put like that, it sounds banal, but given the level of irrationality around the question, it's well worth saying, especially if we are clear about the roots of reasoning in these skills of negotiating the world of material objects. I don't intend to discuss in detail rhetoric of those who deny the reality of climate change, except to say that rhetoric, as King Canute demonstrated, does not turn back rising waters. If you live in Bangladesh or Tuvalu, skepticism about global warming is precisely the opposite of reasonable. Negotiating this environment means recognizing the fact of rising sea levels. And understanding what is happening necessarily involves recognizing how rising temperatures affect sea levels. It's possible to argue about the exact degree to which human intervention is responsible for these phenomena, though it would be a quite remarkable coincidence if massively increased levels of carbon emissions merely happened to accompany a routine cyclical change in global temperatures, given the obvious explanatory force of the presence of these emissions. But it's not possible rationally to deny what the inhabitants of low-lying territories of the world routinely face as the most imminent threat to their lives and livelihoods. And what the perspective of faith, in particular of Christian faith, brings to this discussion is the insight that we are not, and don't have to be, God. For us to be reasonable and free and responsible is for us to live in awareness of our limits and dependence. It is no lessening of our dignity as humans, let alone our rationality and liberty as humans, if we exercise these godlike gifts in the context of bodies that are fragile and mortal, and in a world that we don't completely control. A couple of weeks ago, I suggested that the current financial crisis had more to do with pride than with greed. Understanding pride as the attempt to forget or obliterate our sense of living within limits and lacking total control intelligent life in these circumstances is not the triumphant imposition of human will upon a defeated natural order, but the reasoned discovery of how we live in such a way as not to destroy a balance in the natural order, which we sense rather than fully grasp. It is to turn away from denial, from all those denials of our finite condition, that were summed up many years since in a famous book by Ernst Becker, The Denial of Death, in which he identified the basic pathology of the human mind as the fantasy that we are self-created. Such denial is not properly understood as deliberate refusal of the truth. It is in large part a consequence of the perceived complexity of the global situation. A complexity that produces both paralysis in some areas and a stubborn adherence to failed or outdated paradigms. Jonathan Porritt, in his magisterial essay, Capitalism as if the World Matters, ascribes, quote, the continuing, utterly perverse denial on the part of politicians to a failure to grasp that much of the very complexity which makes people stick to policies they think they understand is itself a result of, quote, the dominant paradigm of progress through exponential economic growth. Unfortunately, he goes on, too few politicians who have grasped the issue have worked out carefully enough what transitional strategies would be possible to reimagine a broadly capitalist practice, that is, an economic practice that values risk and innovation and enables increased collective wealth through trade, that wasn't systematically disastrous for the environment. And his book attempts to offer some starting points for such work, noting soberly that denial of a different kind afflicts many green movements, whose campaigning style allows them to be dismissed or at best patronized by actual decision makers. Among the strategies he discusses is the crucial call to alter the way in which we calculate cost and profit, so as to include some sort of monetary valuation of the depletion of natural capital, and also some way of assessing impacts on individual and social well-being. One consequence of taking this seriously would be one or another form of carbon taxation. The same way, more positively, we need, he says, ways of redefining business excellence in terms of sustainability and deliberate encouragement of low-carbon technologies. No chapter on this. An economic world in which environmental responsibility was rewarded was assumed to be a routine aspect of practice that was both ethically defensible and profitable. Would have a very different flavour from what we've generally seen for most of the last couple of centuries. And it is also an area in which the pressure of the ordinary consumer can make a perceptible difference. More broadly, Jonathan Porritt rightly underlines the close connection of all this with what we ought to be saying about political virtue. We must find ways of opening up a proper discussion of how to restore a sustainable democratic politics in a world where unbridled economic liberalism has in many contexts eroded the authority of elected governments and led some to believe that there is no alternative to current global capitalism but economies of the most static and protectionist kind. All these proposals illustrate what an intelligent response to the environmental crisis might look like. Porritt is clear that this means growth. grounding in carefully defined common values, and in the renewal of civil society through the articulating and promoting of such values, including the recognition of the interdependence of all things and of the equal significance of diverse kinds of capital, social and human, as much as material or natural. In other words, intelligence comes to life when a kind of empathy and imagination is stirred by a new vision of things. Intelligence alone does not generate a new vision, and bare argument does not, on the whole, change things. But vision displayed in new forms of human life and engagement can renew intelligence, in the sense I've been given to the word. And this is where the significance of the perspectives of faith is most obvious. Renewing the face of the earth, then, is an enterprise not of imposing some private human vision on passive nature, but of living in such a way as to bring more clearly to light the interconnectedness of all things and their dependence on what we can't finally master or understand. This certainly involves a creative engagement with nature, seeking to work with those natural powers whose working gives us joy, as St. Augustine says, in order to enhance human liberty and well-being. But that creative work will always be done in the consciousness of costs, seen and unseen, and will not be dominated by fantasies about unconditional domination. It is a vision that, in the Christian context, is founded on the idea of humanity as having a priestly relationship with the natural order. The human agent is created with the capacity to make sense of the environment and to move it into a closer relationship with its creator by drawing out of it its capacity to become a sign of love and generosity. This entails so using the things of the earth that they promote justice between human beings, making sense so as to promote peace, equity, and so on. Using the skills of negotiating the environment in order to alleviate suffering and spread resources. Used in this way, raw material of the environment is seen as serving human need, but only by being used in awareness of its own integrity and its own constraints. It remains itself, but in its use for the sake of healing or justice, it becomes sacramental of the infinite gift from which it originates. The face of the earth becomes an aspect of the face of God. And a good many theologians have started from here in explaining what the actual sacraments of the Church mean, especially the Eucharist, as the first fruits of a world of material things that has been given meaning in the context of communicating divine generosity. And all this echoes what St. Paul touches on in Romans chapter 8. Creation is in some sense frustrated so long as humanity is unredeemed. The world is less than it might be so long as human beings are less than they might be. Since the capacity of human beings to shape the material environment into a sign of justice and generosity is blocked by human selfishness. In the doomsday scenarios we are so often invited to contemplate, the ultimate tragedy is that a material world capable of being a manifestation in human hands of divine love is left to itself, as humanity is gradually choked, drowned, or starved disappearance of humanity from a globe no longer able to support it would be a terrible negation of God's purpose for a world in which created intelligence draws out the most transformative and rich possibilities in its material home. As is true in various ways throughout the whole created order, humanity and its material context are made so that they may find fulfillment in their relationship. Without each other, they are not themselves. And the deliberate human refusal of this shared vocation with and within the material order of things is thus an act of rebellion against the Creator. Which is why Christians are bound to set all this discussion in the context of that divine practice which decisively redeems humankind. God restores relationship with himself through the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. He shows his face to us. And as St. Paul says in 2 Corinthians, our own faces are unveiled as we advance towards God. We are revealed for who or what we are. And in this event, we become able to reveal what the entire material world is for, to display the world as a sign of love through our loving and just use of it, and by our contemplative respect for it and our capacity to let it be. The grace set free in Christ's work allows us to be liberated from the murderous anxiety that drives us to possessive models of engagement. Liberated ourselves, we become able to act liberatingly towards the world we inhabit and whose materiality we share and depend upon. Our own redemption is the recreation of our intelligence. The contemporary Greek theologian Christos Yannis has developed a rich and complex philosophy of relation, stressing that Christian theology sees the human person as purely abstract if cut off from relation with God and others and the material world. He diagnoses the malaise of modern Western society in politics, philosophy, art, and religion very much in terms of a loss of relation and what goes with it, a loss of the sense of vocation to a sort of artistic transformation. Technology, Yannis argues, is toxic when it forgets this artistic and transformational dimension. That is, in the terms I've been using here, when it loses its proper human intelligence. But it's a particular image used by Yannis that perhaps expresses most simply what a Christian account of responsibility in our environment comes down to. In his book of meditations, Variations on the Song of Songs, Yannis speaks of how love compels you to see things differently. Quote, to love the landscapes we have looked at together. And so if we fall in love with God, even fleetingly, all the sense impressions of this world become part of such a common landscape. A landscape we have looked at together. We love what we see together with God. And as I've argued before, if God sees the world he made as very good, I must begin to see it with his eyes, and so to sense in it the promise of his beauty. And it becomes, in Yannis's vocabulary, a gift of erotic joy, encounter with something that generates desire beyond utterance or final fulfillment. Now, it may be a long way from the technicalities of recalculating economic gains in terms of environmental cost to the experience of erotic joy in relation to God. the distinctive Christian approach to responsibility for our environment has somehow to hold these two languages together. Finally, our care for the world we inhabit is not simply a duty laid upon us, but a dimension of life made whole, a redeeming activity grounded in the character of our own redemption, a revelation of the true face of creation as we ourselves undergo the uncovering of our own human face before God. Going back to the root meaning of the Hebrew word, what we're asked to undertake is in fact a conversion, a turning towards the truth, towards the God who is eternally active and giving in ways beyond our concepts, towards the hidden depths of who we ourselves are, and thus towards the face of the earth, seeing it freshly in its unfathomable interrelatedness. As Psalm 104 has it, when God hides his face, creation is locked in fear and slips towards death. When he breathes on creation, when he sends his spirit, creation happens all over again, and the face of the earth is renewed. That turning of the spirit towards the earth is the movement that carries our love and intelligence in the same direction, so that we can properly make answer for, be responsible for, our world. There is time for some questions.
Can I ask about human stewardship of the earth? Would you say that it has got worse, say, post-industrial revolution?
Thank you. I think that the answer has to be yes. Though we shouldn't, I guess, entirely romanticize pre-modern relations to the earth. There are cases of pre-modern societies that have exploited the earth and the animal creation in their own way as much as we have, but with fewer resources. The difference made by modernity, technology, the Industrial Revolution, is that we have so much more extensive means of doing this. I think the sense of stewardship of the earth always depends on that dimension of reverence for what isn't ours. Naturally, I relate it to a robust theological account of what that means. But I think there are very many who, without sharing necessarily the same doctrinal views, say it's that reverence for what isn't ours that underlies stewardship. And whether in pre-modern or modern periods, that is so often what's lacking when we approach our environment simply with this passion for shaping it solely to the human agenda. And it shows itself, if I can just add a footnote, it shows itself in some of the language used in the early days of scientific revolution, where it's almost as if nature is the enemy to be battered into submission. And this is an image used famously, of course, by Bacon. Nature is to be tortured to give up its secrets.
I do feel very strongly the points you make personally. I find it very difficult that in the churches which I preach in, I'm a Methodist local preacher, many people do not care much and tell me even sometimes, when I talk as you are, you're not preaching the gospel of Christ. How can we energize the whole community of the church to see that this is how we can lead the present generation to know the church matters?
Thank you. It's very interesting that in a survey about 18 months ago, in one of the environmental magazines, I think, the people polled, I think, agreed that religious communities were among the most influential potential agents of change in our society. And if we don't take up that challenge, we're really failing rather profoundly in what's expected of us by many people in our society. How do we do this? Well, I suspect it's partly a matter of going on underlining something of that vision which Ellen Davis so brilliantly brings out in her discussion of Leviticus. We are guests on the earth. We are invited by God to be in this place. And that's part of understanding what it is to be created. And the cross and resurrection of Jesus don't save us from being created. They save us from the self-destructive passions and impulses that lock us up and destroy us and our environment. I think it's important just to go on underlining that from the very first page of Scripture. Contrary to what some people think about the biblical view of humanity and creation, from the first page of Scripture, that sense of being guests in the environment is there. But I think it also matters quite a bit to encourage congregations to do what they can corporately in this way. To bring before them the small changes they can make in lifestyle. And some of the changes that can be brought about by collaboration. So the whole movement towards eco-congregations is one that encourages me a lot. I know it needs a lot of argument, a lot of persuasion. But it's there. The possibility is there. That pamphlet which Church House put out a year or so ago, How Many Light Bulbs Does It Take to Change a Christian? I thought at the time, no pamphlet could be as good as that title. But it is a way of saying there are a whole range of small things you can do which are not going to change everything, but they're a lot better than nothing. That's important.
Would you not say that the current predicament which the world faces is as much to do with the explosion in world population as anything else? If we look at the animal world, the insect world in particular, from time to time there are explosions in populations which become self-limiting for various reasons. Also, as a Methodist local preacher, preaching hope, I find this view of the future very pessimistic. I wonder what you have to say. Thank you.
Thank you. The populational question is a hugely complicated one. And I find myself quite confused about it, I confess. I think since the late 18th century, the point has been made, first made, of course, by Malthus, that populations increase exponentially and resources increase in a linear way. And, you know, sooner or later, one is going to lose touch with the other completely. And the immediate kind of common sense response to that is to say, in our context, well, everyone has to consider the limitation of their fertility as an ethical question. What complicates that is that, of course, birth rates are falling on the whole in the wealthier parts of the world and rising in the poorer parts of the world. And to say what I've just said without qualification sounds like yet another Western prescription to somebody else to solve the problem. And that's the kind of conundrum we face here. Likewise, when you see governments that attempt to enforce a policy of family limitation, as in China, you see the most appalling results. Real brutality and inhumanity in consequence of that. So that's one of the most difficult neuralgic points in the whole setting. I wish I could be clearer about that, but I find myself deeply perplexed as to what we should do. I still think it is an ethical question, what we do to limit our fertility. But I'm very, very wary of anything that suggests there's a shortcut there, or that it's simply something we recommend to other people. Hope, as Paul says, hope in what we can see is no hope. And I always think of Nadezhda Mandelstam's wonderful memoir of life in Stalin's Russia, Hope Against Hope. We're not, as Christians, fortunately, we're not in the business of being entirely realistic about hope. We can be as realistic as we like about sin, as realistic as we like about the problems we face, but there's nothing in the Bible that says we've got to be realistic about hope. There's a kind of divine reality which breaks through our realism.
I have two questions. One is, will your paper be published on the internet so that we can all read it and look at it more thoroughly? And the second, which I think to some extent you've already addressed, is how do we then start to translate the message into practice? Because this is, I think, a very considerable problem and issue. Because in your paper you made the point that it's not just the scientific calculations that we need, but it is also the personal response. And the question is, how do we generate that personal response, bearing in mind that we may not have all that long to do it, and also bearing in mind that if we rely on politicians, it may never happen.
Well said. Yes, it will be available, the paper will be available, as from tonight. How do we motivate? I suppose everyone here will have a different answer to that, and there are elements of the stick and elements of the carrot. There's a short story by Doris Lessing, which describes a visit to the Earth by an extraterrestrial who reports back despairingly to its planet that the human race appears to be deficient in a serious sense of fear. It doesn't know what it ought to be afraid of. And that's what we're up against. But that's why the carrot is important as well. The small changes which, unless we make them, nothing will happen. If we make them, it may still not be ideal. It may still be too late. But if we make them, we make them because they're right. We make them because this is the way we ought to be relating to creation. And that's acting hopefully. I've quoted many times in this connection wonderful words ascribed to Martin Luther. If I knew the world was going to end tomorrow, I would plant a tree. I think what's contained in that is there are things that it is right and creative to do, a right relationship, which is part of our healing, even in the face of what may be unavoidable disaster. So it's something to do with getting people to see that intrinsic rightness, the order of relation between us and God and all else that God has made. But how you motivate people to that, I don't know. You do a tiny bit of it, I suppose, by giving lectures in York Minster. But there are quite a lot of people here, and the multiplication effect is not insignificant. So do go and tell people.
Is it time?
This really follows on the last question. Given the seriousness of the situation, do you think the Church ought to be taking a much stronger line, for example, in lobbying politicians, in altering its own investment policy, in suggesting to congregations that they can take positive action? Because the general scientific view is that we really haven't got much longer. And I suspect a lot of people would like the Church to give a much stronger lead than it is now. What are your views on that?
I agree entirely. I think if we are somewhere near a tipping point, then it's extremely important that the Church can rally its support on this. There is at least some possibility of furthering agenda in the public sphere. I think it's very significant that when the churches got their act together in the late 90s over the debt reduction campaign, Jubilee 2000, we did actually manage to shift some of the parameters of public discussion. And one thing that some people on the other side of the river in London, in the Palace of Westminster, say to me from time to time is, we do need you to keep up the pressure. So I think we ought to be saying more. And the eco-congregation model, the willingness of churches to audit their practice, to look at what they're doing and be public about that, that's important. We actually did that at Lambeth Palace a couple of years ago. I think probably, I'll risk saying it, I think the church commissioners probably ought to be a bit more proactive about trying to guarantee eco-friendly cars, hybrid cars for bishops, that sort of thing. That's what we could do.
You've mentioned hope, but I am very aware that a lot of the messages we hear from many people are rather dire warnings. And I wondered how much more influence we may have if we expressed our joy for living in the world. God's world is beautiful, and I'm so grateful to be here. I don't know for how much longer, but surely the joyfulness needs to be part of the message. I'm not saying we can do away with all the warnings, but you spoke about loving the landscape, the whole landscape, and the whole of every being is what I would ask us to celebrate.
Well, if it weren't Lent, I would say Alleluia to that. I think, in a sense, you've answered some of the previous questions. A real joy in creation is or ought to be one of the most compelling things Christians can share with those around them. And I'm very happy always when in Lent, if you follow the old prayer book, say the Benedicite instead of the Te Deum. That is, all ye works of the Lord, bless ye the Lord. And it's one of my very favourite canticles because it expresses just that right relationship between God, us, and the world, which we ought to be modelling and celebrating.
Yes,
so thank you. Well, that brings us